Immigration process is a very lonely journey. No one really is there to look out for you. Smaller companies also don't really have like a formal process of thinking about green card, thinking about like, what does that mean for different employees? So again, I think me, I don't know whether it's because I came from like an Asian household, I didn't ask for it. If I look at my case right now, it's probably going to take another three to four years until it's going to get officially processed. And I have to bank on the fact that my current company will survive in these next 4 or 5 years, you know, as a startup. And if you don't, you know, you pretty much lose everything.
Yeah, and you make a really good point about companies. Like, there are also, like, there are companies out there who are trying their best to keep the talent and to keep you all where you want to be, but the government is not helping in any way, making it much harder for everyone else to be able to help you in the first place.
I come to realization is that this pursuit of the American dream itself has ultimately became my handcuff as well.
Welcome to Bamboo and Glass, a space where two Asian American women highlight perspectives worth sharing. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Tan. As a quick reminder, we share new episodes every Sunday. You can listen to full episodes wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Instagram at Bamboo and Glass to see updates about new episodes and about our personal lives. And also subscribe to our YouTube channel for bonus content.
Awesome. So on Bamboo and Glass, we spend a lot of time exploring how intersectional identities, both the visible identities and also less visible identities, shape our choices and our experience of the world. One identity that's often not very visible is one's immigration status. And we're excited to continue our series centering the voices and experiences of folks who have lived in the U.S. for many years, but whose opportunity to stay in the U.S. is really precarious and dependent on the, frankly, the very xenophobic whims of the U.S. immigration system. So we've heard from Dahi, Nahe, and John, who are in their 20s and earned their bachelor degrees in the U.S. and now are working or pursuing graduate studies. And a lot of people have the misconception that once you finish school and you have a full-time job, especially if you're working at a prestigious company with a global presence, that you no longer have to plan your life around strict immigration policies. Unfortunately, that's not the case, and I've invited my friend MD to share his decade-long journey of overcoming hurdle after hurdle as he pursued his bachelor's, his MBA, and also a variety of other opportunities in a variety of industries. So, hi, MD! Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. And where are you calling from?
I'm calling in from San Francisco.
Yay! Oh, yeah, you were telling me that you actually went jogging near my high school. So you're in the area.
I did.
Yeah, I'm super excited to introduce you to Tan and you to each other. MD and I feel like I've heard so much about you when I was a student at Pomona. It was either through other international students who were like, oh my gosh, I got to chat with MD. Like, it was such an encouraging conversation. Or we actually got to kind of work more closely when we were in student government. I was in student government and you were on the board of trustees. And then I remember the trustees would always ask about student experiences, and you were the one who was always like asking those questions to be like, okay, but like, how are international students doing? Or how are like low income students doing? And just, I think you were someone who really cared about all the different populations at Pomona, because you yourself, you had a pretty marginalized identity at that time as an international student, and definitely had some challenges that were very particular to that aspect of your identity. So we're excited
to get into all of that.
Let's do it.
So, okay, to begin, may you give us a quick timeline of where you lived growing up and where you went to high school?
Sure. Let me just start with saying that I think I came from, and I have to acknowledge that, but I think I came from a fairly privileged background. I was born in China, but I think my dad actually moved to the UK when I was 5 years old to do his PhD. So our whole family basically moved over to UK. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much where I kind of call my almost like my second home, if you will, because the memories before that, I can't really remember what my life was in China as, you know, 1 or 2, 3 year old kid. But I definitely remember like my first memories going into elementary school in the UK and how I was just exposed to a myriad of classmates that just look completely different from me, and everyone speaks English, even though I didn't. So, you know, that basically was my first introduction of a foreign culture. Ultimately, when my dad finished his PhD, our family moved back to China. because he really wanted me to focus picking up the Chinese culture, the roots, because he's really big on making sure that I don't forget who I am and where I came from. So our whole family moved back to China when I was about 10 years old. So spent about 5 years in the UK, went back to China, spent about another 3 years in China in middle school, and ultimately was very lucky to get a scholarship to attend high school in Singapore. So that's when I moved over to Singapore and spent about another 5 years. And ultimately, during that period of time, I kind of got to know a little bit more about what I wanted to do, what my interests were. My parents definitely want me to be a doctor or a lawyer, but I decided that even though I was admitted to a kind of a biomedical engineering program in the UK, I ultimately decided to take a gap year off and really just pursue my own passion in theater acting, because that's what I was really interested in back then. And ultimately, that gap year of acting gave me a lot of exposure in terms of understanding the power of storytelling and exposing the communities that are basically neglected by the general public. So I was very fortunate to be involved in a TV show that portrays the lives of Chinese young firefighters in China. So that really ignited my kind of interest in terms of storytelling and story sharing. And I basically said to myself, I can't see myself going on to become a biomedical engineer, even though I think it's a very well-respected career and profession. And I decided that to give it another shot in applying to the U.S., because I believe that, you know, growing up, I always see U.S. as a place where you really explore about your personal interests and personal growth. And, you know, I think we all heard about the American dream growing up. Mm-hmm. So I thought I'm able to kind of, you know, come here, discover, you know, what I like, who I am. And that's when I ultimately came to the States in 2007. And from there, spent about 4 years at Pomona studying, graduated, and spent about 5 years in the LA area doing traditional consulting. And also spend about, 3 years out of those 5 years doing, I joke to people, but I tell people I sell pants because I work in a tactical performance apparel company that serves the, the law enforcement community. And also the military special forces. So it's a very interesting experience, but ultimately I decided to take another 2 years after that to kind of go back to business school and think about what I want to do next. And now, after that 2 years of business school, I now work at a kind of a startup based in San Francisco that focuses on bringing financing to the couples and women who are going through fertility treatments. So IVF, egg freezing. So, you know, I kind of like to say that it's great to be feeling that I'm part of the force that changes the world, that one family at a time. So here I am. So total, I think, really been the States for almost 13 years. Mm-hmm. Came here in 2007 and here I am, 2020.
Wow. I also feel like your career journey is so eclectic. Like, we need to have you on for our Career Changemakers series as well to hear more about all of these decisions that went into where you are now. And I think also I really appreciate hearing your childhood experience, because I think with international students, especially Asian international students, the perception in America is that, like, you stayed in one place, like in an Asian country growing up, and then you the entire time were eyeing the American dream and wanting to come to the US. But you like grew up in the UK, went to Singapore for high school. And I guess I kind of want to go back to that decision of wanting to immigrate to the US and wanting to get an education in the US. I'm curious, how did that get on your radar? Like, was it just things that your family had talked about making suggestions, or was that something you came up on your own? How did that process look like to lead you to apply to school in the US?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think for me, so I left home when I was 15 to kind of basically enroll in a boarding school in Singapore. So I think I really learned to basically make my own decisions. And I think that comes with a lot of pros and cons. The pros is obviously I learned to learn from my own mistakes sometimes, and that would be the cons. But the pros is you really get to see the power of, you know, personal decision making processes and how it has impact on myself. So I think for me, one of the reasons why I kind of really put US on the radar back then was that just this flexible kind of undergraduate academic curriculum. It's very different than how I experienced education, you know, growing up, in China and Singapore, where, you know, a lot of the courses are kind of almost, you have to pre-select very, very early. And even when we apply to universities in the UK and Singapore, you are pre-admitted into a, kind of a major. So pretty much I was back then, I was pre-admitted into a National University of Singapore, in the business program. And also I was admitted to, biomedical engineering at Imperial College London. So back then, it's just like a natural evolution of your academic career, but there's very little kind of thinking going into what exactly do I want to do with my life. So that's why I think after that gap year, I really kind of went back to the drawing board and say, where in the world can I see myself reinventing myself to completely break away from what I've been learning all this while? And I think US has always been that one location that really kind of allowed me to do that. And I remember back then I applied to USC film school, did not get in. It's super hard. And then I look at the other media programs, media studies programs, basically, in kind of the California area. Cause I know that if I want to do media, do kind of film and, you know, I want to be close to Hollywood. Right. So that's why I think in the end, I applied to Pomona, at the Claremont Colleges, because I think we had a very brilliant kind of intercollegial, media studies program that really spans the cross of five colleges, with very different exposures. So I think that's why, you know, that's like a huge pull from me in terms of like, oh my God, I can actually restart my academic career and learn completely different. That's such a big draw to me. And then something else, which I'll probably go into a little bit deep later, is this is something more personal, is I really come to realize and accept that I'm actually gay. But this only really kind of come to fruition in Singapore. And I went to an all boys high school. That didn't help. So it's like, you know, it's a very interesting process where you kind of go through that whole journey. And I realized that, you know, I didn't feel comfortable that I'm ready to come out in Singapore, where it's still fairly conservative. Even though I think now it's very different. And I definitely didn't feel like I can kind of just, how should I put it? I just feel like I need a fresh start. And I think back then, just doing some very personal preliminary kind of research on Google, it just like, I think US like is this other place of freedom, like a place where it really embraces individuality. I think there's a lot more kind of support for the LGBTQ plus community. Back then, I didn't even know what LGBTQ plus mean. Mm-hmm. But I know that if I were to come to the US, there's a slightly higher chance that I can be who I am. Even though I did not actually do that while I was at Pomona, and it took me a much longer process to actually come out. But, you know, it's, at least I'm very glad I'm here, and now I'm out and proud. But it took me almost like 30 years, I joke, to really come out to myself, mm-hmm. to my friends, to my mom. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's so interesting. That's just so interesting to me to hear, because you're older than I am. Like when I was in 2007, I was in middle school, and
yeah.
to hear, and I know that like same sex marriage, for example, wasn't legalized until like a few years mm-hmm. after that. And so that's very interesting to hear that for you, your, this part of your identity, you just happened to see in America that it would be a little bit more accepted, even though there wasn't like an outright law yet that legalized mm-hmm. same-sex marriage or really said that they defend the rights of LGBTQ plus folks. And I think that's such an important part of your identity that also is being highlighted to motivate your move to the US.
Right.
So,
right. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also noticed you talked, the first half of your response was about this kind of intellectual and like academic freedom to really explore yeah. all these different topics. So actually one of the first things of that I learned about my Pomona International Students Friends experience is they felt a lot of pressure to study STEM because that would give mm-hmm. them an opportunity to stay in the US mm-hmm. for longer. So I'm curious yeah. for you, when did you start, like when you were in Singapore, were you aware of these immigration policies? And yeah. Because it seems like there's a little bit of a conflict here, right? Like you're hoping for this freedom, yep. but at some point you come to the US and you're like, wait, media studies is not a STEM major. I can't yeah. stay in the US very long. So curious what you knew yeah. about all of this in Singapore.
Yeah. And yeah. I want to add on top of that too, because you yes. had lived in different places for like short periods yeah. of time. So I'm curious if you, when you were going to the US, if you had the intent of like wanting to stay there long-term mm-hmm. or if you thought you're just going to get your education and then go somewhere yeah. else again. I'm just curious.
Yeah. No, that's all good questions. I think for me, when I first thought about coming to the US, I didn't really think that far. I think that I definitely see myself exploring this new country, new place for several years. So, you know, in the back of my mind, obviously, I do think that I wanted to stay a little bit longer. I was back then hoping that, you know, just looking at some basic research, I know that there will be work visas I can take on. So I was hopeful that I will be able to stay. And I do know that there are differences in terms of science majors, STEM majors versus arts majors. But I think for me, because I went through that gap year to really know what I want and why I came, it gave me a little bit more boost or stubbornness, if you will, to basically say that, you know what, I am going to major in media studies because that's what I wanted to do. And that's why it's almost interesting. I was one of the very few freshmen probably at Pomona who literally came in, know exactly what I want to do, declared my major immediately, met my advisor, figured out my whole academic plan. I think I actually got most of my major work completed by sophomore year because I was just like so focused. Like, you know, I hustled. And then, but I think one of the things I do know that it is going to be hard for me to end up doing or taking a job in Hollywood in this space, because I actually was very proactive in getting internships as well. And I was very fortunate to get a couple internships. That's when I really started having real, like, actual, let's talk about pragmatism, like with my supervisors at this major Hollywood production company. And there's something that she said really like reminded me. She's like, you know, MD, you're great. I love that you have the passion. But it is going to be very hard for you to get that work visa. We don't actually even sponsor work visa because, you know, there are so many talents in the US just domestically. We have so many talented students from this area, not just from the Claremont colleges, not from Pomona, we're from UFUSC, we have UCLA, we have all these film school kids who wanted to break into the industry. So it's very hard, and we have so many talents, and that's why it's very hard from a company standpoint to justify the need to sponsor, spend more extra money to sponsor an international student to go pursue same type of job. And not to mention that a lot of these jobs at the beginning, you're not talking about very like highly analytical kind of jobs. A lot of this, you do have to work from the bottom. Like, I remember my internship was literally filing film proposals, which is already, I think, is a lot cooler than a lot of other people are doing. I was getting all these basically, you know, producers from all over the world who was like pitching their proposals. So I remember I was getting these files, folders, trying to like label them, like put a little sticker on them, literally putting them into like a folder. And then, you know, like I think I was actually given a little bit more authority that if I want to review it, I can actually recommend it a couple to my supervisor to take a second look. But otherwise, I just file them. But that to me is really cool. So it's like, but still, I mean, you know, from an immigration standpoint, the work visa was really created to attract high skill talents. And if you look at the nature of that job, it is. I mean, if it were to play devil's advocate, it really didn't really fit into that criteria in terms of like high skill job, because you are just reading, you're filing. And that's kind of where the entry level is for a lot of these kind of entertainment business roles back then. So, I mean, we had a pretty long chat and I came back to school and I remember, okay, this is kind of defeating, but, you know, I'm still hopeful. So I want to see what else I can do. So one of the things that I was very fortunate to get exposed to during that internship was I was also in meetings with these consultants who came into the company to basically help the company think about how they want to go to market. Do they go to theater first? Do they go on DVD first? You know, how do you think about the marketing plan and all that? So that's the first time I was introduced to the concept of business consultants within the business, in a media firm. And I thought it was fascinating. So I came back and I kind of like went to some of my friends who are very busy networking, who are studying economics, and they kind of like, oh yeah, consultants. It's like, you know, they are business consultants, of course. Yeah, it's a very great career. You basically start as a generalist and you basically get to do a little bit of everything. So I thought, okay. Then I started, to your point, Sophia, like I really kind of think about how do I find something that allows me to stay somewhere on the peripheral of the media entertainment business while allowing me to stay here and maximizing my chance. I think that's when I become a little bit more realistic than just being an idealistic person saying that, you know what, I'm going to keep pursuing media production. I'm going to figure it out later. I become a lot risk averse after that conversation, hearing from, you know, the hiring manager of a very prominent media production company. So yeah, that pretty much changed my entire second half of the trajectory of the college. And you'll think that, you know, sometimes, you know, that's why sometimes it's almost scary in terms of what kind of advice you hear from other people, right? Yeah. It's like, to me, it's that one single conversation that changed the entire second half of my trajectory, which I will get into. There are definitely good things. There are definitely things I regret, but I pretty much immediately declared a second major in economics because I know that, okay, what do I need to get stay here as a consultant? And the other requirement for us to work in the US is whatever you study has to be somewhere related to your your work. Mm-hmm. So you can't, even if I were to become if I continued as a media studies major and ultimately get a job in consulting, there is no guarantee that that's a valid connection. You can argue it is, and maybe it will be approved, but I didn't want to take the chance, right? The school never at any point said that you should not major in media studies because that is not relevant to consulting. They never said that. But from a student perspective, it's our immigration case that's at risk, right? So, you know, from my perspective, there is really no one sit there and tell me that, hey, MD, just keep doing what you're doing. At the end of the day, I think, you know, this is all rational. You know, you can still be hired by a consulting firm with your media studies degree. Don't worry about it. I don't think about that. I came all the way here and I want to stay. So obviously I want to maximize my chances of winning this game. So therefore, my second half of my college career, I dedicated to taking on economics as my second major. And I'm very fortunate that I was able to learn a lot from my advisor, Professor Fernando Lozano. And I think he's a fantastic advisor and I learned a lot. But I do wonder sometimes in terms of what other things I could pick up in a great liberal arts education at Pomona. And I remember I'd always joke with some of my friends that, you know, they ask me like, what is your favorite class at Pomona? And I always tell them it's a religious studies class that I took in my last semester, because that's the only semester where I finally completed all my economic coursework that I can have a couple more kind of units to try something else. And just taking a class that is nothing to do with my upbringing. I was raised in a very secular family, not exposed to faith at all, but just learning about, you know, and this is actually like faith in Southeast Asia. So it's like, to me, it's so fascinating. It's just, I was just so like drawn to the different kind of faith and practices and the kind of the spiritual texts. But that's it. That's only one class and I graduated. So, you know, if I had to look back, could my experience be different? Absolutely. Could I expose myself to different concepts? Absolutely. But I was bound by this game that I'm trying to play. And for me, I'm not advocating that everyone should do this. I definitely took a hit on it because I really want to make sure that I'm maximizing my chance to stay in exchange for some of the other academic, intellectual learning I could have gotten. So yeah, that was just kind of like my reality of what happened to me back then.
I have so many thoughts from everything you just said. I'm trying to like remember everything. Right now I'm doing a transition and I'm going to be going to film school and like I'm learning a lot learning about the entertainment industry and like how unstable it is job wise. And so on top of what you mentioned about how there are so many talented people in like SoCal area who are domestic students who they would prefer to give the job to just to not worry about the logistics. I also imagine even if you did get a work visa, you don't have your job for very long a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Like you have to bounce around between different gigs. And I imagine that that's whenever you're applying, it's probably like every time I imagine like you're thinking like, is this company even going to give me the sponsorship just for like a few months even? So I really feel for you on that one just after learning about all of this. And then the second thing was when you were talking about like the system, like gaming the system, and about how you, like in, with the immigration system, you have to study the same thing that you are going to go get a job in. That just makes me think about all like the career panels and all the career events I've been to and people who I've talked to who've always said like, oh, it really doesn't matter what you study. Like you can do whatever you want. And that's just like a portion of the people in the room can't relate to any of that. And that, that just makes me rethink all like everything that people had told me before, and like the privilege that I have as a U.S. citizen. And then the third thing was like you mentioned at the beginning, you came into Pomona and you like got all your requirements done. You were like ready to go. You had your game plan, and then from one conversation for you to all of a sudden almost be playing catch up to finish your second major. like that just really breaks my heart, honestly, because it's like you had all this fire and vigor and rigor to get through your education so that you can have the best possible career, best possible future, and then all of a sudden, like, you learn like the realities of like, oh, there's a lot of other things I have to consider in order to just have the basic desire to stay in the US. And yeah, now all of a sudden I'm way far behind my other peers who weren't as prepared as me when I started at school.
Yeah, it almost feels like you were penalized for being yourself and penalized for having all of this introspection that brought you to your gap year, brought you to the US, brought you to Pomona specifically. But I'm curious, like, what other aspects of your life did your immigration status, you know, shape? And what other choices did it shape?
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. I think Don actually mentioned one that I want to briefly talk about as well, which is like, how do you transition between jobs, right? Like, how long do you stay? Because I think that's something that is actually pretty critical. And I think for me, it's sometimes it's like there's so much information about immigration that all these information are changing all the time. And I just remember sometimes when I first graduated from college, I didn't do a good job of really doing my own research. I remember after 2 years of doing consulting, I was ready to transition into another job. I remember that And there's definitely very few of us, but there are definitely people like me who are a little bit too eager. We quit our job too soon. And we'd find out that actually the transfer of the visa has not been completed by the immigration services. So you can't actually start your second job. So I was kind of like in this limbo state, and I was like, oh my God, like what if the transfer is not approved? Then I would have already quit my first job. I would have been out of immigration status. So, you know, I definitely made a lot of mistakes along the way like this before.
But also because, it's like such an inconvenience and frustrating to have to worry about that on top of just trying to find a job that like basic needs of like, I feel psychologically safe and my well-being is really good in this workplace. Yep. I work with people I genuinely have a good relationship with. And I just think I just think about like the most recent law that Trump and ICE had passed like for internationals and then how they rescinded that a week after. Like, I would imagine it's so exhausting and very stressful to have to be on top of all of these updates, especially when like just the signing of a paper can really jeopardize like your immigration status and your ability to go back to like see your family, for example, or to even keep your job in the first place. So
for sure. I remember out of the three jobs I took, and this is just something that I've been reflecting on personally as well, is again, I think I've gotten more privilege along the way, because now I'm at a startup. I'm literally one level away from our founder CEO. I think she's been extremely supportive for my immigration status. But I remember when I was in a big company in my first job, as much as I love my job, I have very little, I wasn't even given the option of potentially being sponsored a green card because we're so low in the
really? Like, you know, and it's such a big company
It's a big company. And I think back then the policy is unless you're a manager level and you work for the company for 6 years, we would not consider you for green card. So that is not even a thing. But then again, I hope, and I haven't really been following the policy these days. I think back then it was very different 10 years ago. I think now if you were to join a earlier stage startup or even the big tech companies, I would imagine, and I hope that there's more flexibility given to undergrad fresh colleges students that really give them that boost, give them that peace of mind. Because I knew that, you know, for my first job, I'm like, okay, there's no chance I'm making manager. I'm just an analyst and the green card is off the table. And then I think for me, I wish that someone told me that I could argue that for myself. And as I transition into my second job, and this is also something I learned along the way, is, you know, immigration process is a very lonely journey. no one really is there to look out for you, because if you even want to join my second company, the second team that I work for, extremely supportive, talented team, but our HR department is also very small, right? So and smaller companies also don't really have like a formal process of thinking about green card, thinking about like, what does that mean for different employees? So again, I think I don't know whether it's because I came from like an Asian household, I didn't ask for it. You know, I think that's one of the biggest regret, you know, I think for me is, I know I'm a top performer, in the company I work at, and, you know, it's a great team. I just never really think about like arguing for myself and say, hey, could you sponsor my green card? Because I think it'll be very important. So I've worked for the second company for 3 years. I did not even bring up a single conversation. So that's on me. But what I'm saying is that, you know, like, for all the people who are listening to this, you know, if you're going through this process yourself, if you know that you're a good performance, you know, you, if you know that you're a good employee, you're a good teammate, you know, advocate for yourself. And if you're a good manager, you have good teammates on your team, you know that they're international, advocate for them, because it's really a lonely process. And unless you really know the intricacy of these, I don't blame my managers at all, because they didn't really know what I was going through. They know that they hired me under a work status, but, you know, they didn't know that all these immigration challenges that I'm going through, and they have a lot of things on their mind too. So I'm trying to be empathetic as possible. So I think it is partially my own fault, and I wish that I have really stood up for myself in a sense. But I think that's something I really want other people, you know, the ones who came after me, to really take that away, is if you are working with a really good team and they are quite, they have, you know, they have hiring decisions and they can influence upwards, I would say, yeah, talk to them, bring this up. It's not a something that you should be ashamed of. And I think for me, I felt shameful because I felt like I haven't proven myself. But I think we all deserve to have that conversation. So I think, which is why now, for the final time in my final job right now, on the startup team that I'm work for, the founder is extremely generous. I think the moment that she signed me on full time, she's like, MD, we're going to start your green card process right away. But still, as a Chinese citizen, this process takes about, you know, 3-4 years. So it's still a very long process. And we can get to it later, because, you know, everything is, it's so unpredictable, especially with COVID. You know, like, many startups out there went through reorgs, and we did too. So I think I'm very, very lucky to survive the reorg. I'm still here working with the team, but who knows what's going to happen down the road, right? So I think there's a lot of ups and downs when it comes to these processes, and it's a very lonely journey, because you're really bearing all these stress yourself. No one else really understands what you're going through. I think part of me felt like I found a lot of support from my other international friends who are going through similar communities. And a lot of times, it's not that we don't want to reach out to our domestic American friends. It's just that, you know, unless you really live it, you feel it, it's really hard for you to understand what we're going through, and we don't necessarily want to burden you guys as well. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, we got this, you know, like, it, hopefully we got this. It's kind of like you're just really like holding on to the hope very tightly. I think it's a tough journey. It's a tough journey for many of us to go through. And there's so many of us who are still on this journey.
I really relate to what you were saying about being hesitant to even ask your manager to advocate for you, because like Sophia and I, we've talked about how it's so easy for us to see like something that's personal to us to ask about that with our manager. It feels very selfish, and it feels mm-hmm. like such a big inconvenience to them. And yeah. The last thing you want to do is to be an inconvenience to the other person. And I think this is, I'll speak for myself, like I grew up always seeing like teachers or managers as like people of authority. So like seeing a power yeah. dynamic. And so it was always very nerve-wracking to ask for anything, because I would just like to think that everything's available for me readily. And I am just, it's on me to take advantage of it and not really need to ask for help, just to be able to do my job just by the study materials that are given to me. Right. And I think about like the struggles I've had of like asking for things from my manager, and it's not anywhere near close to like the struggle of like what happens if I can't get a green card, if I can't get my work sponsored. So that's all I want to say.
Yeah. You touched a little bit about the different places you worked, and you know, after Pomona, and I'm curious, you know, how did your immigration status shape your choices around the timing mm-hmm. of when you transitioned, and also which yeah. companies you specifically sought to yeah. work at, and also which MBA program you applied for?
Yeah, great question. So actually, it's less so about the timing, but it's actually the willingness to take us in. And I think that in the current climate over the years, you know, one of the questions that we all get this kind of like very negative reaction to is, you know, it's a very simple question on application forms, and it doesn't impact most of the applicants, but it does impact us, which is, would you need a sponsorship for this job?
Oh, it's like a checkbox.
It's a checkbox. And a lot of these companies use this as an automated resume screening function, and they will never tell you that they're using this it's like a default question to screen out resumes. And I think a lot of the, you know, for certain companies, And I know that for higher ed institutions, they also ask these questions. So, you know, if you're looking at, you know, colleges who are looking to hire international faculties, they also ask this question, but they will specifically say that, you know, they will not use these for discrimination purposes and all that stuff, and which I hope that is the case. But I can say for all the companies out there, they're using this as a, you know, a way to help them prepare to hire more internationals. My hypothesis is this is just an outright question that helped them filter through, because a lot of these, because again, like I've done hiring myself as well. I know how many resumes I get just from a simple startup. I can't even think about, you know, in this current day and age where there's so many layoffs happening, just like in one simple LinkedIn job could lead to 200 over applications. And these kind of screening questions do help the recruiters do a better job and could help them figuring through. And obviously, I don't know how prevalent this is across all the recruiting industries. I think it would be very responsible for me to say that everyone uses these questions to screen out. But at least I think the inclusion of this question in applications definitely is one of those first things that triggers a kind of a, you know, it's not like I would never apply here, but I'll tell myself, I'll ask myself this question, Sophia, since you asked me, it's like, do I want to apply here? Because like, do I want to go through this effort of putting together all these applications, resume, referrals, go talk to someone else, put my resume in, if there's this question up front to ask me, do I need work sponsorship, right? So it's like, it definitely narrows the scope in terms of where I want to apply for and who I can apply for, or fundamentally change how I look for jobs. That's why for me, sometimes, like at least between my first job and second job, I was fortunate because I didn't proactively look for a job. I was headhunted by a search firm for my second job, and they didn't ask me upfront in terms of whether I need sponsorship. And I think I was very lucky that they did sponsor me when they moved me through the final round. But remember, I was lucky because I graduated in 2011. That's when the market was just barely recovering. So I didn't graduate into 2008, 2009. So I remember back then when I graduated, the work visa actually still has a lot of allotment left. So the way H-1B works is like, you know, everyone can file, but if there's not enough, there's like a threshold where it's like, I think 65,000 a year. So if you graduate into a market where the job market is generally, you know, just still recovering, I didn't have to subject to lottery. Whereas now, when you graduate, you're subject to immediate lottery to figure out, because typically the number of applicants way exceeded the allotment. And then, you know, I think right now, I was literally talking to someone else yesterday, actually also from Pomona, a good friend of mine. This is his second year. First year, he got the lottery, but he still got denied because, you know, after you get the lottery, you go through the official review process. And I can tell you right now, since the new administration came to place, there's a lot more stringent requirements on the H-1B visa. It makes it a lot harder for undergraduates, especially, to get the H-1B. It's easier for us with a graduate degree because you can argue that we are actually having, you know, high skills to go into the job market. And also we command a much higher salary compared to the undergrads who graduate, right? So with all these new changes in immigration policies, I've heard so many rejections coming in from the undergraduate community who just got their job. So this friend of mine graduated from Pomona in 2018, first year, win the lottery, but got rejected in the actual H-1B review. This year, they didn't even get through the lottery. They didn't get picked for review. So now they're really worried about, they have one more chance. And by the way, yes, they did pick a STEM major to give them 3 years. So that's three chances. So now they're wondering. So they call me. They're like, can we talk about career? Because I don't know at this point, where should I spend my time? Should I go get a PhD just to enroll in the PhD so I can spend my, you know, spend another 5 years here? Or should I prepare to go to Canada? Like, where should I go? So it's a very tough conversation because I was very lucky. Again, that's why I think despite all the struggle I have, I constantly remind myself that I'm also the lucky one. I graduated into the market where the job demand, the market demand was not that intense. Now, I don't know what's going to happen. So that's why I think when I look for jobs, a lot of the times, I wouldn't say that I don't put in applications. I really spend more time networking. I talk to people more because I realize for me to get through these, I really need someone who believe in me as a person and then really are willing to spend that effort. And let me tell you, my current company, so the founder, like we really believe in the mission of bringing financial equity and access to families who can conceive naturally to help more family complete their families. We met when I was still a student in my business program. And then she immediately agreed that after I graduated, she will sponsor a green card. And even that, it was a lot for a startup to take on, because my H-1B, even though I graduated from a great business program, was still selected for a request for further immigration, request for further information from the immigration office. So the company has to pull together all these documents with the lawyers. It's like additional expenditure for a startup as well. And then they also filed the whole green card process. And now my case just got picked for an audit. And then that audit process extended my green card for another 10 months. And then the company has to spend more money with the lawyers to basically continue with my case. So if you think about it, there's a reason why a lot of companies don't want to hire international students. Like, if you really put yourself in a founder's shoes, I feel bad for them too. Like, they want to hire talents, but this is asking them to do a lot more than to keep their company afloat in this whole situation, right? So how many companies can actually say that, don't worry, we're going to hire equally? You know, we're going to, regardless of where you come from, we're going to make sure that we hire the best. Yeah, I think there are companies out there who can do that, but you're asking them to take on a lot more responsibilities given the current immigration climate. So that's why I think overall, this is a really tough time for not just companies who want to do the right thing, but also for students who are trying to find a job, because it's just overall, everything is really working against us at this point.
Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned that, seeing that little checkbox about if you require work sponsorship, how that raises a lot of questions for you. Like, is this going to be used as a filtering tool? Because
right.
I guess when I've seen that question, I had thought like, oh, it seems like they are aware about a work sponsorship and they have experience in sponsoring folks.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you've heard any stories or if you've experienced yourself application where you don't see that checkbox, and then along the way they find out that you are international and need work sponsorship, and then the entire process gets backtracked as a result.
Yeah. So personally, I haven't seen those before, but I definitely knew and I heard of classmates who got those. And I think back then, they basically said that they are hiring for long term. And at this point, is again, like I said, it's not the company. I mean, you can argue it's a company's fault, but they really don't have much to work with either, because they can recruit you for 1 year, and then later you're not going to get the H-1B. You're going to get booted out of the country. And it's easier if you're working for a big firm like Google or McKinsey, where you have global offices. But if you're a startup and you have one employee that's stranded out there, it creates so much more complexity in terms of, you know, teams and everything. So unless that's why I kind of go back to, do you know that founder? Do you know that team personally? Are they willing to take on this risk? I'm not saying everyone doesn't, but definitely it is a lot more to ask for those companies. And that's why I think I've heard companies where they somehow find that out fairly early, even though they don't immediately find that out in the screening. They will probably talk about it in their first kind of conversation with a recruiter. So you probably pass a resume, but you still have these like recruiter screening. They'll ask you about your salary expectations, and they'll get through these questions, because I think good companies try to put these things up front. And then the unfortunate thing is sometimes, a lot of times, they don't tell you why you didn't move forward. So you can only, you know, assume that's for other reasons. But once you start seeing the patterns in terms of who gets moved forward, who doesn't, you can also make some assumptions and, like, you know, extrapolations as well in terms of what's going on, right? So that's why the whole hiring process right now, it's changing. And like I said, I can't say that every company out there is discriminating against international students. I know there are firms out there who's trying very hard to keep us, and there's so much advocacy that's going on. But just realistically speaking, like, how long can these companies like hold on to these processes, right? Because they're so complicated, and it varies across different nationalities as well. Like, for Chinese and Indians, like, our process is way longer than any other nationals. Oh. So like, it's the immigration process set up, and you can also argue that it's fairly, you know, if you look at the structure itself, yeah, it is kind of, it's good. It's fair. I mean, they put allocations across all different nationalities, so everyone can be equally treated. So I respect that, but the implication of that is there's a lot more Indian students and Chinese students who are looking for these kind of sponsorships. So, but we're all subjected to that allotment. So that's why, you know, like, if I look at my case right now, it's probably going to take another 3 to 4 years until it's going to get officially processed. And I have to bank on the fact that my current company will survive in these next 4 or 5 years, you know, as a startup. And if you don't, you know, you pretty much lose everything. That's why I think there's so much complications. And there are definitely other things that, you know, I won't go into the details in terms of technicality of it. There's like, you can transfer your green card into another company as long as they're willing to restart the process for you. But I'm just saying, all these process, it's a whole work, like it's a homework that we have to do for ourselves. And not to mention that the best example, the best responses we always get from everyone, it's like, oh, you have to talk to an immigration lawyer. Like, we don't want to, like, we want to help you, but we don't want to give you the wrong thing. So go talk to an immigration lawyer. But these lawyers, they don't give free consultations either. For me, I can schedule one for $150 upfront consultation, no problem. But think about the students who just graduated from college, right? Yeah. Like, you know, why, who has that kind of money to just go like throw in $200 for initial consultation, where you're just really talking about some preliminary kind of options, right? So again, it's like the process itself has gotten so complex that really only the immigration lawyers know. And then a lot of us are just trying to, like, you know, rely on forums and, you know, anecdotes to figure out what's next. So yeah, it's a lot to kind of navigate.
Yeah, and you make a really good point about companies, like, there are also, like, there are companies out there who are trying their best to keep the talent and to keep you all where you want to be, but the government is not helping in any way, making it much harder for everyone else to be able to help you in the first place. And I'm also just thinking about, because my parents, because I was born in Korea, but I immigrated with my parents when I was 10 months old, and so my parents went through the process of, like, getting H-1B, getting getting the green card, and then they got naturalized, and so as a result I got naturalized because they did it before I was 18. And I really want to emphasize what you said about it being a very lonely process, because you don't even have family that went through this process. Like, you don't have, it's not like something your parents went through where they can coach you on it now that you are of age to handle the immigration process and system. Versus, like, for me, like, if my parents had never gotten citizenship, let's say, like, they still went through, like, the H-1B visa process, and, like, they would be able to help me understand it. So I
don't even
really feel
them.
For you. Because it's like, can they do? Like, they can't do anything to help you. Like, all you can do is, like, keep doing the research, reaching out for help whenever you can. And that's also just a very vulnerable part of yourself to always have to share. And so that kind of leads me into my question about, as policies were changing and as you were navigating, like, these difficult situations and decisions, you mentioned, like, your current startup is a very supportive place. Like, you're the CEO, founder is very supportive of you and wants to help you get the green card. I mean, you're wondering if your previous workplaces were also places of support, like, not just managers help providing support for you with the actual process and logistics, but also, like, did you feel like you were able to, like, confide in, like, your coworkers and to let them know, like, hey, like, maybe today I'm not going to be able to do that as much work because I am dealing with really difficult things that are taking a toll on me emotionally and mentally?
Yeah, I think for me, I would say that a lot of my previous jobs, I think the teams are great. I think, like I said earlier, I think it was my own fault that I didn't really share as much, because I felt like it's such a personal issue, personal challenge, that I don't think anyone else in the workplace should care. Because I think it's almost like you can argue, right? I love that you guys are doing, like, this whole new thing about debates, right? Like, should you debate? Like, is an employee's immigration status a personal issue or a workplace issue? I don't know. I don't have a question. I don't have an answer to that. Because if you're saying it's a personal issue, then it is kind of personal, because you do have to, I mean, like, again, when we talk about immigration, I'm talking about me. I can tell you that I'm Chinese. There are undocumented students in this country too, who can openly talk about where they are, and they prefer not to talk about it. So, like, you know, in that case, how do they navigate? I don't even know how they navigate this whole process, right? So, and then you're talking about, okay, then folks like me who want to get help, but who do I talk to? Like, I think for me, if you're in a medium-sized company or a smaller company, you have access to founders, you have access to VPs. But when you're working in a bigger company, like, a lot of the times, you don't even get your hands on your own immigration case, because there's so many, because what we don't realize is HR and a kind of immigration, all these are kind of risk mitigation functions, right? So, like, ideally, they want to make sure that, you know, they are really managing on your behalf, so then you don't really get in, you don't create more work or complications for them. So that's why bigger companies' immigration process is even a bigger black box. Like, I've heard, like, where my, so again, going back to that same employee, same friend that I talked about earlier, like, when he found out about his immigration status last year, like, he couldn't even get feedback from the HR department, because they don't want to tell him, like, more details. You're navigating these, you know, bureaucratic processes in a bigger organization, just trying to, like, maximize your own chances of, like, you know, figuring out what to do next. But for me, I think I was lucky that I was working in smaller organizations. But still that has its complications because I don't know who exactly is the point person I should talk to. It's not like, you know, green card is like a title, right? Like HR is a very broad function too. And not everyone in HR is trained to really, do the kind of green card processes. And I think that a lot of the companies out there do tend to tie green card with your performance. So it's like, you know, we're going to do it, but you know, you have to at least, you know, show that you are, I mean, that's kind of at least to me for my first job. At least this is 10 years ago, they tied at the managerial level and they want to see you committed to the company for X number of years, because then it's like, okay, you're not just using us for a green card. You actually really give them back to this company. And I get it. It's realistic and it's reasonable. You can argue it's reasonable, but still to cap it at such a high level, you know, it makes it so unreachable for so many other junior employees.
Yeah, and other people aren't held to that same standard either. Like they don't have to go through a process of having to prove themselves in order to stay at the company. Like maybe they have to prove themselves to like get a promotion, but not to stay at the company, or not definitely not to have a green card or to be able to stay in the US.
Yeah. So I think for me, it's like, I think I genuinely hope and I genuinely feel that in this current climate, there are more companies out there who are willing to help. But I think it's to what degree, right? Like, is it one person per company, two people per company? I don't know. Because at the end of the day, every new person you take on, you're taking on uncertainty. And you're asking the leaders to basically champion for that individual and say that, you know, we're going to make this work out. You're asking a lot for whoever is making the hiring decision. So that's why so much is on the line for not just us, it's for those companies as well. So that's why it's a great question. But I don't know right now in this current climate. I'm only with one company. I don't know how many, what are the policies are at the different peer companies out there. You know, the overall sentiment is we want to be supportive of immigration. We would like to make it easier. But, you know, just looking at hard data, it is hard. It is hard for international students to get jobs these days. And it's almost like you have to be creative in terms of what kind of, how do you game the system? How do you play it right? So that's why, you know, it's an art almost, you know.
There are a lot of coworkers of mine who are not permanent residents of the US, and so sometimes I don't even know how to talk to them about this. I don't know if this is something that it's like a very sensitive topic that they would prefer for no one else to talk to them about, or if they really feel really lonely and they want someone who they know is an ally and who is aware of their situation. So what kinds of, like, how do you wish your coworkers or also your classmates in business school, how do you wish they had talked to you and started the conversation to make it easier for you and less lonely for you?
And what are some missed opportunities for folks to be an ally to you?
Yeah, I think in general right now, what's going on in US, in this country, is there's, you know, we are just one of the many I wouldn't even call us marginalized. I think we're actually privileged in a lot of way. I think we're just dealing with a different system, right? Mm-hmm. But still, we had our own challenges. I think given what is going on right now in this country, it is a lot of cognitive load to ask everyone to fully understand what is going on with us, given what is going on in this country, which I think is deeply problematic to begin with. So I think what I wish that people would do is sometimes just, you know, nothing special, but just check in with us, you know, just keep talking to us and just say, you know, you never know how the other person is doing unless you ask for them. Like, just check in, and then you will get a sense of whether they want to talk about it. But I think sometimes it's just really trying to say, you know, hey, I know that you're, like, for example, I think I've been very fortunate that a lot of my peers and my classmates have been extremely supportive. And if you know, like, a classmate who's interested in doing something, just keep sending them leads, you know, and help them expand their scope. Because for international students, I hate to say this, at the end of the day right now, it's almost like a numbers game. It's like, how many jobs do you know that there's someone who's willing to vouch for you? That maximizes the chance of us getting through those, you know, screening processes, right? So if everyone else can open up their network, can really generously share and vouch for you, and just keep sending you opportunities and leads, I think it would really go a long way. Because that's the most important thing for us is ultimately, we're just looking for that one job. All we need is that one job, one place who is willing to take a little risk, take us on, and then we'll prove that we're a great teammate. And I think a lot of it right now, it's hard because everyone just have so many things going on right now. And the thing is, especially hard now that everyone has a lot on their plate. You know, we're not talking about international students. We're not talking about Black students. We're talking about everyone in this country. We're not talking about just students. We're talking about like recruiters, employees, employers. Like everyone has so many things on their plates. So it's like, how do you bring this up as like something that they should really focus on? It's really hard to like surface this up, bubble it up, right? So that's why I think it's important just for us to go back to the basics. And I say that, okay, like if we really know someone who's good, you know, someone who's really working hard, then check in with them frequently just to see how they're doing and, you know, get a sense of what they're trying to look for, what kind of jobs they're looking for, or maybe they're not looking for a job and just send them some stuff. I think right now, because everything is more virtual, it is even, sometimes it could feel even more isolated than even before, because like a lot of these things you're just really dealing with, you know, yourself. So that's why I think I was very fortunate that I think I have friends who reach out to me all the time to just check in on me and see how I'm doing, you know, how the immigration status is doing. Sometimes it could be kind of like, oh my God, it's like, yeah, there's not much I can tell you, you know, I'm still in the process, but just knowing that there are people out there that really, are watching out for me, it goes a long way. But that's why I don't think there's like any missed opportunities, because like I said, it's like, this process is so convoluted. Sometimes we don't even know how to explain it to our peers. It's like we're still learning what's going on. It's like one day this changed, another day that's changed, and wait, that's a rumor, and that one got rescinded. It's like we're constantly being like played almost. Like, oh my God, did you hear that? Oh my God, I have to go read up. But like every single thing that's going on out there triggers like, you know, like a whole emotional, you know, reaction from us. We have to go make sure that, okay, does it impact me or not? Okay, it doesn't. But does it impact someone else? And sometimes like I feel bad because sometimes I don't even have the capacity to think about other people. I'm like, first, like, will it impact me first? Right. And I think I actually went through a whole struggle personally for the past couple of months, because I think I was going through a lot personally that I felt like I wasn't able to be fully present and be present and make an impact during the Black Lives Matter movement, because my own immigration case literally was going through like a complicated process. And for me, it was a lot of pressure on me. And as a result, you know, I didn't participate in any protests. I used to be a lot more vocal, but like during that period, I wasn't as vocal at all because I have so many things on my mind. And then I turn around and I'm like, wait, I feel so selfish. And I started to like hate myself for not caring about the Black Lives Matter movement as much as I should. And then someone else finally came back and said, hey, MD, before you can love other people, you got to love yourself. Because I think the biggest thing I learned from her, she told me that compassion and empathy is not a zero-sum game. Just because you allocated more to yourself for that period of time doesn't mean that you completely neglected other people. So don't be so harsh on yourself. And I think that she actually saved me, because I was in a spiral. I was like, oh my God, I can't figure out my own immigration problem. And then I can't really fully participate in this big movement, which is so important right now in this country. I just feel bad. I was like, I'm not a good person. You know, I got to the point I realized I can control my immigration case and I'm now helping my Black community, my Black friends. I'm just like, gosh, Andy, you're a bad person. And I'm like, no. Finally, after several weeks of like debate, someone else finally told me and said, hey, that's a completely different way. That's a wrong way of looking at yourself. Like, be kinder to yourself, right? So that's why I think, you know, for me, it's like, yeah, like I'm just glad that I do have friends out there who are willing to kind of like just really push in, even though sometimes I get really enclosed in my own space because I just don't know what to do. And I think there's a lot more people like me out there. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, I would say that, yeah, just keep reaching out to the friends that you care for who are international, because I think right now I can only speak for my own experience. And I think that I'm already at a much privileged position than a lot of the international students who are graduating from undergrad with no work experience. I have 7 years of work experience. I'm still struggling, and I can't even imagine what the newer generation of international students are dealing with right now with all these things that's happening. So
I really appreciate your tip about sharing job leads with people, because mm-hmm. I think even for me as a domestic student who has never had to deal with just this mess of and the kind of convolutedness of this whole process, just like someone sending me a lead, Talon sends me leads a lot. She's like, Sophia, you want to make something happen? Go talk to my friend. And
go do it.
And it just reminds you that they're of like the possibilities that are out there. And like when you're, mm-hmm. when you're lonely, when you feel so stuck, that's a great tip. I will definitely do that in the future. Kat, what were you saying?
Oh, I was just saying, MD, I know I just met you in this recording, but I just feel like you have such a huge heart. Like, like while you're talking, like we're here to talk about like the kind of the challenges and the struggles you face as an international student, and you keep bringing up like, I know I'm really privileged, I know that other people have struggled so much, and your story about like how you were beating yourself up about how you were dealing with your immigration case and you couldn't really contribute as much to Black Lives Matter as you wish you had. I just want to say that I'm glad that you have a really great support network that is reminding you that it's okay, that you need to be compassionate to yourself as well, while and that you are doing a lot of great work in the first place. And I also really appreciate how you mentioned all the time, like how it's like you were seeing the perspective of like companies and employers about how hard that is. Cause I feel like it's so easy to villainize or to see companies as like one dimensional entities that just want to get money all the time. Right. And I just feel like you being able to see all these different perspectives does allow you to be like such a great ally to so many different people, so many different groups of people. And so I just wanted to highlight that in our conversation. And I just really, really, I'm just very, very honored that we get to talk to you. But I also do want to bring it back to how you had mentioned one of the motivations for coming to the US was knowing about the freedoms of being someone who is queer. And I know that Sophia wanted to bring up a conversation that she had with you before this recording.
So we caught up 2 weeks ago and you were telling me a little bit of the things that have been on your mind recently. And you said, when I came to the US, I was so excited for the freedom of being able to live openly as a gay man. And now I'm here and I have that. Like, I know you've been in a committed relationship with your partner for quite a few years now, but it has come at a cost of all these other restrictions and limitations. So I'm curious, like, where kind of where are you at with this tension? How?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on all of that now?
Yeah, I think that's like the existential question, right? It's like, where do I go from here? And I think it's a great question to have. And I will be honest, I don't have an answer. And I think that it's a struggle that I'm still dealing with. That's why I think it's a work in progress for me. I definitely admit that. One of the things I come to realization is that this pursuit of the American dream itself has ultimately became my handcuff as well, because I think a lot of what I do is really about, oh, I want to stay here. This is the only place that's going to give me an authentic life. This is the only place that's going to allow me to do what I want. But hey, look at what we just talked about for this past hour. Am I really doing what I want on a day-to-day basis? I'm not sure, you know. I think there's things out there that I would love to do more. And that's why, like, I messaged you two separately. I was like, hey, I really love what you're doing, because I study media. I love storytelling and I love to meet people. And in fact, for me, it's like, what you're doing is great. You're building this platform for other people to share their stories. And that's what I love doing, because at the end of the day, I think my story is not, I mean, I don't think my story is as important as all the other stories out there, because here's the thing.
Your story is also important though. Just say that.
Yes, it's all important. It's all important. But just imagine, like, how many more can we learn as a community, as humans, if we get to hear all the stories out there, right? And I think right now, in terms of media, there's this just overemphasis on, you know, professional success, or, you know, like what people think about starting new companies, whatever. But one of the projects I really love over the years, in the past couple of years, is the Humans of New York project. It's just like, it really is bring it back to the basic about humans. Like, what are we doing? Who we are, what we're struggling, right? So like, I love to do that, have a platform, but I haven't been doing that, because guess what? I can't do that with my current visa. I have to do it on the side. And for me, I'm someone who really give my work 100%. So I don't have the bandwidth to like really do something on the side and taking care of myself. So it's like, there's all these competing priorities. So that's why I think for me, the restriction really is around, like, can I really live and work and do really what I love and work what I love and, you know, be who I am. And I really want to spend more time championing for LGBTQ issues in Asia. But right now I can't do it because I'm all the way here. And there's a lot of other things I'm dealing with just personally, like family wise, I can't do that yet, but I want to do those things, right? So a lot of the time it's like, I'm trying to figure out, like, when can I do that? Like, when can I actually truly be myself? And I think when you talk about authenticity, is not just about coming out and be a gay man and, you know, and tell the world that you're a gay man. But it also should be reflected in, you know, how I carry myself every day. Like, what kind of work do I do? And that's the standard I hold for myself. And I know that there's a big missing piece right now. I'm not spending enough time doing what I feel most compelling to me in terms of like bringing social justice to the communities that I care for. And I want to do more of that. So that is a missing piece. And I think that it's something that I've been struggling with for a long time. And that's why I think this year it's an interesting time. It's a really interesting year for me personally, because we are all locked down in our houses. We are stripped away all these kind of external distractions. It gives you a lot of time to spend on introspection, right? And I think for me, it really start to make me feel like an experiment. I can do things differently, right? So that's why I ramped up coaching college students. I've been doing coaching for the past 6 years, but I ramped up the volume entirely because I feel like I feel like there's so many things I can't control. I can't control my immigration. I can't control, you know, how the company's entirely is doing. I can't control, like, you know, the COVID-19 spread cases. I can't control any of those, but I can control the conversations that I have with other people. And hopefully I'll be able to point these college students in some way that can really alleviate their pain, you know, right now that they're going through a lot too. So I think, yeah, for me, coming here, pursuing this American dream is largely anchored on getting this green card. And I start to admit that I felt like that mentality is fundamentally flawed. And I think that, you know, this American dream that I'm really pursuing has to be revisited, because I think right now, just there's so many changes happening. And I need to ask myself too, is like, how much longer can I afford to play this game of the immigration game? And are there better alternatives out there in terms of where I can spend my time and energy, right? Because I think that's the other thing about the whole COVID-19 situation, is it really allows me to go back and look at my life. And I think the ability to live every day is such a big privilege. It really is a huge privilege. And I think that, you know, every once in a while, when there's a close family friend who passed, we go into this mode of deep introspection in terms of how we want to spend our time. But this year is like where everything just really kind of accentuated, because there's just so many deaths happening, right? It really makes me wonder, like, you know, I'm really lucky to wake up every day being able to work from home. So like, with this kind of privilege, shouldn't I be doing something completely different? Like, shouldn't I be doing something that has a larger impact on the underserved community? And I think there maybe is. So yeah, I think right now I am still struggling. I need to figure out when and what I'm going to do. And that's why I don't have an answer. But I do know that I start to question the fundamental kind of goal, the end goal of getting this green card, to get my quote unquote American dream. I start to question that a lot lately. And it actually is quite liberating, because it suddenly frees up a lot of the other things. I suddenly see myself, okay, maybe there are other places I can go. There are other things I can do. Maybe it is time for me to leave the U.S. I don't know. Now, later, it's quite liberating, that I can say, because suddenly I just feel like the whole narrative I built for myself, there are definitely some serious flaws in it. And I think to be able to acknowledge that and accept that, I think for me, that's a step forward. I think that will be my first step. And then where I go from here is going to be a work in progress. And hopefully I'll be able to figure that out in the next couple months.
Yeah, it's like you're liberating yourself by deciding the system that is keeping you here is no longer your cage. So mm-hmm. you are now able to explore other options. And I also want to point out that, yeah, a lot of people who want to do like side hustles, for example, like they always say, oh, like, how do I do my full-time job but then also do this thing on the side? But for you, like, your self-care, like, you're doing your work and then your self-care is also dealing with immigration and trying to get a green card. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, you want to do like storytelling and like serving yeah. underserved communities as well. So I feel like that's not easy in any way. And also, mm-hmm. I just want to say, I hope you don't beat yourself up over
Thank you.
The fact that the American dream was something that you held on to for so long, because that is a narrative that so many like immigrant families and immigrants have been taught, and we're told that once you get here, things are smooth sailing. Once we get here, we're going to have all of the success and all of the achievements that you can possibly imagine. And that's just not the reality. And in a way, the year 2020, like, it's 2020 is like clear vision, clarity, and I feel like we're getting a lot more clarity on that. This is not the end all be all. And I'm really glad that you're now you now feel the agency to like explore other opportunities as well.
I was reading this Instagram post the other day where it's like the American dream is a form of gaslighting where the American dream tells you, oh my gosh, just come to the US. Opportunities everywhere. And you come to the US and you fight with immigration, you come to the US and you, you know, experience all these other challenges that no one advertised and no one told you about, and you feel bad. You're like, wait, am I, you know, aren't I supposed to be living my full self? Aren't I supposed to be pursuing my passions? And I was like, damn, like American dream for sure, gaslighting so many people.
I thought when you said Instagram, I thought you were going to say that the American dream is like an Instagram filter.
Okay, I like that.
Yeah.
So we started our episode with you talking about actually a lot of the different experiences you have with storytelling and media. So you worked as an actor, you studied media studies, you interned at Participant Media, you created a documentary, and you also shared your coming out story with your classmates in business school. And so recently there have been several TV shows and movies about immigrants or immigration. So Never Have I Ever, The Half of It, and Jane the Virgin. So I think Jane the Virgin is the one that explores immigration to a little bit more depth. So for example, I think the grandmother had fled from Venezuela to the US and she eventually gets a green card. And like, oh my gosh, the scene where she gets a green card is so moving. And you see how much she hid in the shadows and how alone she felt before she had the security of a green card. So I think you are in a position where I'm really curious to hear your perspective as someone with experience in media and as someone with such a long journey with immigration in the US. What are aspects of the immigration process and what are aspects of immigrants' lives you wish were showcased more in media?
Wow, that's such a great question.
I'm so excited to hear what you say.
One of the things that Don brought up, which I thought is really interesting, is our immigration struggle is always this parallel layer that's permanently on our lives. It's never the prominent one, but it's always there. And it's never the only thing that we care about, because there's so many other things that matters to us. But yet it's also one of the most important ones that we pull onto. We hold so tight onto. So there's this constant struggle in terms of like, you know, where do you position it in terms of your priority list, right? It's like, is it the most important? Because for me, I can tell you there are times I'm just like, I'm just going to keep kicking that can down the road. And I wish that sometimes for me, I'm more diligent about it. Like I literally have friends who are joking. It's like, gosh, 13 years here, you can't get married. You can't just marry an American person. Like you have to put yourself through this whole process. Why don't you pick the easy route? Literally everyone who talks to me right now, who jokes with me, it's like, but they're coming from like a place of care, right? But they're like 13 years, you could have just married someone. And they're very honest with me, right? But it's my personal choice whether I went through that route, right? But it's like, from then, it's like, I think they're coming from a place of care because they understand that is a fast track. And I know that too. It's like, yeah, marry an American would have saved the problem immediately. But that wasn't the path I chose personally. So I think one of the things I wish that in terms of media exposure and everything is, I mean, a lot of their stories that we've seen so far, ultimately, you know, even look at the different films out there, you know, there's these struggles between people trying to get married, whatnot. But I think it's just like, I think what I'm trying to say is like this whole immigration piece is not always the only thing that's top on our mind. There's so many of the things that we are worried about. We are trying to spend tension on, but this is like this little bug that's like just always in us and we can't get it out. And we're constantly trying to struggle between how much time we spend on curing it or attaining to it. And it's a struggle for everybody. So I think everyone who goes through immigration will have such a different path and have such different conflicts. I think immigration itself is creating a lot of tensions in different aspects of our lives. And I think that it will be really good. It'll be interesting if there's like kind of more media exposure, really exposing all the different kind of factors that are kind of impacted by immigration. So like actually going back to like the employment thing, right? Like I'm not trying to like say, I'm trying to, you know, say that, oh, let's give more empathy to all the employers, but there is very little exposure in terms of how employers are going through this process too, right? So I think that the whole immigration process is very one-sided, by now from our perspective, but even then you can argue that there's so many more stories that you can tell. But I just think that it will be great to kind of bring all the people who are impacted by immigrations into the spotlight. And then you realize that this is why it's actually a much bigger systemic problem than this. The hiring process could be entirely innovative, but no one's doing that because for whatever reason, there's just no time and commitment to do that. It's like the immigration, if you really want to change the status quo, it's not just the government. Employers have to play a part too. We have to play a part too. Our community, our friends, family have to play a part too. And I think that for me, it's really like, it's a, like Sophia, you kind of talk about too, that it's that isolation. Like we are kind of in the dark too. Like I don't talk about immigration for my own reasons. And there's a lot of other people who don't talk about it for whatever their reasons are. So, and then the irony, I know friends who got married because of, you know, they want to get through that process, but they don't want others to know that they're married because they're afraid that other people are going to judge them for, hey, I know exactly why they did that. Because, you know, so-and-so did it because they want their green card. You know, like you never know. It's like, but these kind of commentary does hurt. But it's like all these different kind of narratives around immigration. It's like, you'll be surprised how much microaggression there are as well, even just among the immigrants. That's why, you know, and this is bring up a completely different topic, you know, at the end of our conversation, but
please.
It's like, you know, there's like friends, a lot of my, there's not a lot, but there's several Asian American family, friends of mine, you know, they know their parents voted for the current administration for the single reason that they believe that they fought hard as Asian Americans to get to where they are today. And they do not. They actually love the fact that he's building a wall. He's making it harder for Mexicans to come in. And I'm just like, that is just like, this isn't, I find it really hard to really accept that. And my friends couldn't do that either. And for reasons, they haven't talked to their families for months because of that too. So it's like, but this is only one example in terms of the microaggressions that's happening within the kind of our community. And then, you know, even like us, it's like, you know, sometimes like I've heard stories about, you know, both are international students, but then they're talking among one, you know, because, you know, one person got it, the other person didn't. It's like, it's creating so much more tension and jealousy in terms of how did they do it? Oh, because they, you know, they just married, you know, that's what they did. They did the shortcut. It's like, why are there so much microaggression within our community when everyone is pretty much all kind of subjected to the implications of the immigration process, right? There has to be more understanding, more empathy, but it's a hard process. It's that's why I think it would be great if medias can literally go down to the root and share more stories of the individuals. And then kind of goes back to my point. That's why I think there's stories in this day and age is so important, because so many people are struggling, not just us immigrants, like all walks of life are struggling in their own communities, and people need to understand each other's lives. There's so much more you can learn. I think that humans do connect on the individual level, and you'll realize actually we're so similar in some ways, but yet our lives are so drastically different. And I think that that's the best way to build empathy. It's like you see yourself in them, yet you realize, holy crap, how can they live a life like that while I'm living in this life, which is so much better. So I think that would be my, I'm not sure if that answered the question,
that's
but
wonderful.
But I just think that there should be more stories to be told
just,
by everyone.
Yeah, just more stories in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a couple of episodes where we've highlighted like education and politics. And the takeaway that both of those guests said was that politics applies to everyone. Education applies to everyone. Like it affects everything that you do, like on a day to day basis, whether you know it or not. And I think the message of this episode in a way is like your aspect of your identity as an immigrant, as an international student, H-1B visa worker or green card applicant, that does affect many other parts of your life, whether you're conscious of it or not. Like when you brought up the whole like marriage part, like I wasn't even thinking about how immigration affects like your love life, like your romantic life. And like for me, like right now, I really hate it when people try to put timelines on me. And I've just been thinking about it from the aspect of like a woman, like so where people expect like a woman to get married by a certain age or to like be the caregiver and stuff. And I hate it when people say that. And I can't even imagine like if I were in your position and this was potentially like a really practical option for me, even though I'm also struggling with like the gender norms that are being placed upon me. So MD, I really hope you make a short film or tell some stories around these topics. I think it is
so
necessary.
Oh, thank you. I mean, that's why I think it's like you two have really been the pioneers for providing these platforms, which is, to me, it's really inspiring. Actually, it is. And when I look at it, I was like, wow, this is really great work that you are doing. And that's why it really got me thinking as well in terms of what I can do to tell these stories that needs to be told.
Oh my gosh, we'd be so excited to support you. If podcast, YouTube channel, like, we will share you with you all the things we've learned in this last 1.5 years, because it's been a lot. Yeah. We've experimented a lot.
I'm sure.
Well, to close, so MD, you had shared a lot of encouragement and advice throughout the episode, but I wonder if, you know, you just had any final words for any international students who are listening to this, any final words of encouragement or advice?
Yeah, I would say the most important one is know that you're not in this by yourself. It might be a very lonely process. It could be a very lonely process, but watch out for the signs that other people reach out. I've encouraged that more people reach out, your friends and family reach out. So take those. It's okay to say no, but acknowledge their friendship, their help, because I think that it is already a very lonely process for many of us. And I think that we should be grateful of all these outreach coming from our friends. So cherish those. Sometimes these processes could take years. Sometimes, you know, you might meet someone, the love of your life. And then I would say, yeah, you know, if you ended up doing marriage, I would say live your own life. Like, don't worry about how other people criticize how you went through your immigration process. You own that process entirely. Like, you know, and be proud that you eventually, if you make it, when you make it, share it. Because I think a lot of the times I get a lot of help from folks who went through the process already, and they're telling me all the things that you can do. And which is why, like, you know, marriage is one of the highly recommended options. And I love my friends for it, but it's not the one that I chose personally, but still I thank them. That's why I said, you know, it's like, it's a joke, but it's also, I'm grateful that they care about me. They kept on putting on my radar. Right. So yeah, really that. And I would say that, but finally I would say the same thing is ask yourself, ultimately, what do you want to do with your life? Where do you want to spend your time? Because America is great. It taught me a lot. I built families, built friendships here, but the world is out there. Anywhere you feel like you can learn, you can grow, I would say, give it a thought. Think about it. You know, don't be like me. Don't be so stubborn and stuck on this one dream that I hold for so long. Like, think broadly and be daring, more daring. I think it'll do you good.
Thank you so much, MD, for sharing your journey and sharing so many words of encouragement to our listeners. And to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. MD, I was wondering, did you want to plug like any social media for ways that people can reach out to you or learn more about any works that you've done?
Yeah, no, I would say feel free to find me on LinkedIn and send a connection if you want. You can find me at just MD Ma. MD and MA, and then you can search for Pomona. I think typically that will do. And you know, if you want to reach me via email, I don't know. Do you all provide email links in the show?
Yeah, we'll put it in the episode description.
Yeah, we'll do that. And I'll feel free to reach out to me. Like I said, yeah, feel free to reach out. Happy to chat more. Very honored to be here.
Awesome. And we're so honored to share MD's story today. And we hope that all of you listeners were encouraged by their story too. As always, if you want to continue the conversation further, please DM us anytime on Instagram at Bamboo and Glass. We love hearing your reactions because it reminds us why we do the work we do outside of our full-time jobs. And we're always excited and grateful to receive them. And we also always send your encouragements to our guests. So if you have anything to say to MD, send it over and we'll share it with him. So thank you again, that. MD, for being
You're
with
welcome.
Us. And to our listeners, we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye. Bye.